to test this to see if it is recording. Just let it run for a little bit, and then that leaves a blank space at the front of the tape so I can put in whatever I want to later. You know, the name and address. Well, here I am back in Anchorage talking to Mrs. Elwell a second time. I'm sorry to bother you a second time, but I thought your story was very, very interesting, and your life particularly.
Thank you.
And so I'm sorry that tape got lost up. I'll take all the blame for that. At any rate, we're at 126th and a half 11th, West 11th.
In Anchorage,
I'm talking to Mrs. Mamie Elwell.
Right.
Who is known as, when she wrote, she used the name Niska Elwell, right?
Right.
Right. And you, if you don't mind, could I just go back and do a little biographical sketch on you, where you were born and when, and your maiden name? You were born in...
I was born back in the Middle West in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
On October the 1st, 1892.
1892. In Ohio. So 1892, that makes you 82 years old?
Right.
Good heavens.
Good heavens is right.
That really surprises me. I would guess about 65.
Oh, them's kind words.
No, I would. I really didn't realize you were that,
thank
that
you.
Old.
Thank you.
You've led a good life to look so good and young and healthy.
Well, I led a pioneer life. Maybe that helped.
You are a long-time Alaskan. You've
yes.
lived in Alaska.
Yeah, we came here in 1920.
1920. Were you married at that time?
Yes.
And your husband's name was Luke, as I recall.
That is right. Yeah. I was a war bride in the First World War.
Luke Elwell. And what was your maiden name?
Grimm.
Grimm.
G-R-I-M-M, like the Grimm brothers.
G-R-I-M-M. And do your friends call you Mamie, or do they call you Niska?
I've been called Mamie for 50 and some more years. And then all over Alaska is Mamie.
Do any of your friends refer to you as Niska, or is that just a pen name?
Niska is a pen name, and I might explain that. When I was a campfire girl, when I was a kid, we had to select a ceremonial name which was supposed to denote your characteristics. Well, I was the only outdoor girl in my family. All my other sisters were indoors girls. And they called me the wild goose because I was always wanted to be outdoors. Well, wild goose in the Cree language is Niska. So I selected Niska as my ceremonial name in the campfire girls. Well, when I started to write way back when, all I knew was outdoor stuff, and that was what I wrote. And none of the editors would buy it when they saw a woman's name on it, because they thought a woman knew nothing about
outdoors.
The out-of-doors. But then I started writing under the name Niska, and they didn't know the difference. They would write back, Mr. Niska Elwell. And I wrote under that name all for more than 40 years, and they didn't know until the last few years that I was Mrs. Luke Elwell. So it was a good pen name.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting how you developed that pen name. It's logical.
Yes.
Very, one of the most logical explanations. I have a logical explanation for my name. My name is Mike. My father just wanted a boy, and he didn't get a boy the second time, so I got named Mike whether it was a boy or a girl.
Well, I was supposed to be a boy, too. That's why I was an outdoors girl.
So, It's kind of interesting, the experiences you have because of the name. I expect you've had more than I have. But the other night at the Pioneer, a week ago last night at our Pioneer annual Christmas dinner, a friend of mine went up to one of the daughters of the Pioneers to help serve. And they take plates of food to the guests from the Pioneer home. And this lady went up to this one girl and said, "Are you Mike Dalton's daughter?" And she said, "No, I don't know him."
Oh, don't know him.
Yeah. My daughter is 18, almost 18. So, did you, you and your husband have children?
No, no children. No.
And you were married in 1920, so that was...
No, we came north.
You came north in 1920.
We were married in 1915.
1915. And were you married in Ohio?
Yes.
And was Luke, your late husband, was he from Ohio?
No, he was born in Aberdeen, Scotland. And his parents brought him to Boston when he was a kid. And he started a school in Boston, but he had that Scotch burr in his language. And the kids all made fun of him, and he had to fight many battles on account of it. Mm-hmm. And then his father was in the granite business. Mm-hmm. And then they afterwards moved to Ohio, and that's where I met him.
I see. Mm-hmm. Did you go to school together?
Or? Yes. We weren't in the same classes, but we went to the same school, same high school.
You were married in 1915, and then... he was in the service during World War
One. That's right, yeah. He was 2 years in France in the First World War.
So, then when he was, he wasn't retired from the Army, discharged from the Army, then did you stay in Ohio for a while before you came to Alaska?
No. We came west and lived at Yakima, Washington a year or two before we came to Alaska.
Mm-hmm. What brought you to Alaska?
Well,
the outdoors, I know, but
well,
what prompted the trip up here?
Well, we had two dreams. Back in those days, they had what they called Nickelodeons when you went to the movies. You only had to pay a nickel. And they started having the first beautiful mountain pictures. Pardon me. The first beautiful mountain pictures that were taken out in the Rockies. Well, we fell for those mountains, and we wanted to get someplace where we could see the mountains. And the first pictures of the African game came on the screen at that time. I think Martin Johnson was the first one to film the African pictures. And we wanted to get to Africa and see all the wild animals. And we wanted to get to Alaska and see the mountains and all the wild animals in Alaska. Those were our two dreams. Well, we got to Alaska. And we stayed rooted here 40 years before we ever got to Africa.
Is that right? But
we finally got to Africa too. And but by that time my husband was disabled and we couldn't hunt, and we'd hunted all our life and we didn't want to hunt any, kill any more animals. So we bought a picture safari and took movies of the African animals.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes.
What year was that you went to Africa?
59 and 60.
So you planned that one a long time and took your time.
That's right.
That's good, to take a trip. So many people will take trips of a lifetime, and then they'll spend 5 or 6 days and come home.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them, but that's great. But you were in Yakima. When you decided you'd come to Alaska, what precipitated that? Did your husband have an offer for a job, or
we were young and adventurous.
Come.
We were young and adventurous, and we just took a chance.
So you came to Seward?
Yeah. My husband was also a young surveyor in those days. And when we first got to Seward, we came in the autumn, the poorest time to get anyone to find a job in Alaska. But in the old, I can't recall the name of what they called a hotel in those days. But Joe Badger was he was quite a character. He owned a hotel at that time. Joe de Badge, we called him. Well, in the lobby that night, Luke and Tommy, the boy who came north with us, overheard some engineers talking about a job that they had to get done before snow flew, and it was very late in the autumn then. So he hit the engineer up for a job, and he hired both my husband and Tommy, the boy who came with us, on a survey crew. So he was lucky in getting a job right away.
Did that job last all winter?
No. It lasted until Thanksgiving. And I might tell you something about their homecoming. Well, I wanted a dog team. So, when I got to Alaska, the first thing I wanted was a dog team. Well, I was left alone in Seward, and the boys went off on this survey trip, and they wouldn't have a woman along on the trip, so I had to stay in Seward. Well, I wanted a dog team. There was none available, but Rush and John, another character who lived there, was going westward, and he wanted to sell his dog team. And it consisted of two big dogs, half as big as horses. Mm. Well, I bought them. And Rush and John went off westward, and I hitched up the dogs, and they got into a terrible fight. Well, I had to settle that fight, which I finally did, and got them off on the trail. And there was a fight every time I hitched them up. So I had quite a time with that team. But I went downtown with them the first time, and they took out after every cat they saw in the town. And they chased one cat right up on a woman's porch. And it ran up the window, ran up the top of the window, and sat on top of the window, and the woman came out of the door with her broom. Beat the dogs off.
Yeah. What kind of dogs were they? They must have been hard or something to be that large.
They were a nondescript breed. Heaven knows what they were. They were woolly. They were between 3 and 4 feet high, but they were woolly. Heaven knows what breed they were. They weren't St. Bernard or what's that other large breed?
The Great Dane.
No, they're not woolly.
They were sheepdogs.
Yeah. Well, they looked like sheepdogs, only they were bigger than sheepdogs.
Yeah.
And they were awful. They were a terrible team. Well, on Thanksgiving night, the boys came home. And I had rented the only house in Seward that was empty at that time, and it was a big stucco house up on the bluffs, out over what used to be the sawmill on the Lagoon Road, they call it now. Well, the boys came home, and of course we were celebrating and laughing and hooping and hollering in the house. And all at once, a regular landslide came down the cliff behind us. And we opened the back door to see what it was. And the two big dogs had pulled up their dog kennels by their roots and come down on the back porch to see what all the noise was about. So that was the boys' introduction to my dog team. Well, they took them out and tried them out the next morning, and of course they got in the usual fight, and they had a time getting them separated. Well, they had driven, each of them had driven a dog team coming from Hope. At that time, they were surveying the road between Moose Pass and Hope, Alaska.
I see.
And they had come in with dog teams because the surveyors had to haul all their gear and stuff mm-hmm. in by dogs. So they'd had a little experience mushing dogs on the way in. Well, those two big dogs were too much for them. Luke made me get rid of them, made me sell them. But anyway, that was my first dog team. We had many dog teams afterwards. We never had as bad a one as that one.
Well, that was the winter of 1920 then. Did you stay in Seward that winter?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And Luke find another job for the winter, or did you make it through the winter without?
No one worked in the winter in those days. Everybody worked all summer, and you come home and paid your bills, and you lived on credit all winter, mm-hmm. and then you went out the next spring and got a job and paid up your bills again. That was an old Alaskan custom in those days.
Well, did you remain in Seward then after arriving there, or did you move out the next year? You've spent a lot of time in Seward, I know.
Yes. We owned a home there for 16 years, but we weren't in it too much because our work was always seasonal. First we went to the gold mines and we're coming going seasonal.
What gold mines were they?
Well, we were in the Cache Creek district.
Is it
Peters Creek?
Oh, that's up here by Tokyo.
Uh-huh. We were in Peters Creek and Cache Creek District, near Talkeetna.
What years do you recall, or approximately?
Well, it was in the 20s.
And on
into the first part of the 30s.
Okay, so then in the summers you'd go into Cache and Peters Creek areas.
Yes.
And mine.
That's right. And then after Luke got a guide's license, we didn't go back to mining after that.
I see.
In those days, a guide had to spend 5 years packing and cooking and being an assistant guide before he could get a guide's license.
What's it like nowadays to get a guide's license?
I can't tell you because I don't keep up on the game laws anymore.
And whom did he train under or hunt with?
Andy Simons. And Hank Lucas.
And were they out of Seward?
Oh yes, they were famous old Kenai guides.
Andy Simons, S-I-M-O-N-S?
That's right.
And Hank Lucas?
You know, there's a mountain down there named in his memory, and there's quite a memorial that the forestry has put up that has a picture of him and has his history on it. That's down at the end of Kenai Lake.
And when your husband Luke got his guide license then, did you headquarter out of Seward, or did you have a headquarters site where you guided out of? Or?
No, at that time, Seward was our headquarters at that time. But the guides hunted around all over the territory because, you know, the same kind of game wasn't all in the same place. If they wanted caribou, they had to go north. There were no caribou on the Kenai at that time.
I see.
And vice versa. If they wanted big bears, they went to Kodiak or went out far westward on the old steamer Star.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they hunted around all over the territory.
How did he get his clients to take hunting? I mean, he made a living at game guiding. So how did you and he
well,
get
in
clients?
Well, in those days, the guides didn't advertise, they didn't need to.
People sought you out?
Yes, by word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those days, only the rich people from the East were the ones who hunted. An ordinary man couldn't afford to pay for a big hunt.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly New Yorkers or a lot of the aristocracy from Europe used to come hunting over here. And that was what most of their clientele was composed of. And it was that way until after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody hunted.
Yeah, well, there was a big influx of people then.
Yes.
And then the airplane came, so it
made a big difference.
More of the country more accessible to people.
Yes.
If your husband, when your husband went on a grizzly hunt, that would be a bear hunt down in the Kodiak area. Tell me how many people would go with him, and would you go with him, and would he go by himself and just take you, or would he have an assistant guide?
Well, at different times, it was different conditions. When he first hunted, you see, the first 5 years he had to hunt with Andy Simons and Hank Lucas, and he went with them, and they went on the old steamer Star to get to Kodiak or westward. And they took their packers and their cook with them, and that's all. The guides, what necessary, each hunter had to have a guide, and they took their packers and their cooks. And then afterwards, Gus Gellis of Anchorage banded the guides into a guiding outfit, and he got a lot of pack horses. And he used to go all over the territory with pack horses in those days. And
it was Gus Gellis? You say his name is Gus?
Gus Gellis.
Was it G-E-L-L-I-S?
E-S.
G-E-L-L-E-S. Gus Gellis.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, pardon me. After a while, that outfit disbanded, and then Luke was guiding on his own. Hank Lucas and Andy Simons were dead by then. And We owned the place at in Seward. We owned a house in Seward for 16 years. And then we sold that, and my husband built a fishing and hunting lodge at Upper Russian Lake, which is halfway between Seward and Anchorage. And we had all our fishermen there at Upper Russian Lake, but for hunting, he still hunted around all over the state by then, whichever game the hunter wanted.
After he got his license, did he have a partner, or did he?
No.
Would he occasionally partner up with somebody on a hunt? Or?
Well, yes, if you'd call it that. What they did was hire extra guides.
I see.
They hired extra guides and paid them. Mm-hmm. Paid them regular guides' wages.
So then, what did you call your place there at Upper Russian Lake?
Yeah, Elwell's Fishing Lodge.
Elwell's Fishing Lodge.
That's right. We were up there 22 years.
22 years.
Mm-hmm.
Was it accessible by road, or did you have to fly in or walk in?
You had to fly in or hike over a forestry trail to get there.
How far was the trail, the hike?
Well, from Cooper's Landing, it was about 17 miles to Cooper's Landing, mm-hmm. from the lodge.
I see. You must have built it yourself then, out of logs.
Oh, we did, yes. There's a picture right behind you. That's the main building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the main building there, and then we had 7 or 8 little guest cabins scattered around in the timber.
Log structure.
Yeah, it's all logs.
And you cut the logs right there?
That's right, yeah.
Is there a road into this lodge now?
No.
It still isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And do you still own it?
No. No, we sold it. After my husband got disabled so he couldn't work, we sold it.
I see. And after your husband was disabled, did he have a stroke or was he injured? Or?
Yes. It was heart trouble and he had a number of strokes.
I see.
And then he, after that, he never could walk well. He had to walk with a cane.
So you sold your lodge, and then did you move into Seward or Anchorage?
No. As long as he was alive, we traveled. We had no children, and we decided we'd spend the money while we were both alive and could enjoy it together.
Wonderful.
And we traveled for 10 years.
Yes. Oh, that's great.
I thought it was. We enjoyed it very much. But the happiest years of our lives were those 22 years we spent up there in the woods at the lodge.
At Elwell's Fishing Lodge.
That's right.
Do you remember any dignitaries who came up to your lodge to hunt and fish, like governors or?
No governors, but we had a lot of writers and noted people. Barrett Balkin.
Mm-hmm.
As you remember, was very famous in this country during the Second World War because he was, for one reason, because he was the only man who had flown over both the North and the South Pole.
Right.
Nothing to it now. They fly over the North Pole every day, and the South Pole, there's a USA, during a geophysical year, had a camp, presumably right at the South Pole. But at that time, that was a very remarkable deed to have done. And Luke guided him once on a hunt, too. And he and his wife was a very charming Norwegian woman. And she was also a writer. She wrote books in her own language.
Mm-hmm.
And during the war, when her country had been occupied by the Germans, she had been in the underground and been a courier on skis for the underground. So she was a very interesting person, too.
I imagine she was.
Yeah.
I bet she had some fantastic stories to tell.
Yes. And turn it down a minute and shut it off a minute.
Okay.
Our hunters and fishermen included an Austrian count and a baron, English lords and their ladies, an earl, a French general, 2 South Americans, a Mexican senior, New York millionaires, industrial giants, Southern aristocrats, and Colonel Barrett Balkin, the famous Arctic explorer. Also, General Twining, who was chief of staff of the Air Forces, and his children. FBI agents on vacation, Treasury agents, doctors, lawyers, Texas oil men, cattlemen, curators of museums, and scientists. We enjoyed at the lodge some musicians of radio, TV, and record fame. Donald Novus, the tenor, who immortalized the song Trees and Sylvia. Eddie Peabody, the banjo king. We met Lauritz Melcher, the Danish basso, formerly of the Metropolitan Opera, who was kind enough to sing folk songs to amuse his hunting party. Writers who have come to our paradise are Corey Ford, Alastair McBain, Dan Holland, Frank Dufresne, Ira Gabrielson, Rusty Annabelle, Ida White Sharples, Jay Williams, Kay Kennedy, and Jean Potter.
Now that's from, you read that from your manuscript of your book.
That's right.
Well, at your lodge, you and Luke were there. Did you have any help, or did just the two of you operate it yourself?
We kept it small, so many of our friends tried to twist our arm to enlarge it, but we wanted to keep it small so we could do it ourselves and to keep the Alaskan flavor. And we kept pioneer conditions at the lodge.
Well, you operated out of there for 22 years, so do you recall the year that you built the lodge and started and actually lived there?
Well, it was just before the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there until 59.
So then it would be the late 30s. The late 30s that you
did. Yeah.
Uh-huh. 38 or 39, somewhere in there.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, when you went in there to build that lodge, did you fly in or did you hike in?
Well, we hiked in when we first... How come that lodge to be built? When Luke started guiding, at that time, there was kind of an unwritten law. The Kenai, the older Kenai guides, each sort of had their own territory that they hunted in, and they didn't infringe on each other, although it was just an unwritten law.
Yeah.
So when Luke got his guide's license, the older guides that he had broken in under told him, "Why don't you take that territory at Upper Russian Lake?" They said, "There ought to be some good sheep heads up there now, because that was hunted by market hunters when the railroad was being built. And then they put a law on it, and no one has hunted in there for years. And now the law is opened again, and there ought to be some good heads." So Luke established that as a sheep hunting camp, and he hunted there several years for sheep and got some very big record trophy heads who went into the record book.
Mm-hmm.
So he liked the place, and we built a little trapping cabin to stay there one winter. And he liked it so well, then we built a lodge.
I see.
So it was a trapping cabin that turned into a dude ranch, actually.
Yeah. A dude ranch that you had to hike into or...
Fly.
You could use dog teams to get in there.
Yes.
Did you and Luke ever have an airplane?
No. Luke learned to fly, but he never owned a plane. If he wanted a plane, he used to rent one.
Mm-hmm.
It was... It was cheaper to rent a plane than it was to own one and maintain it.
During those 22 years that you lived at the lodge, I expect you had dogs, a dog team. Or did the two dogs and Seward discourage you from the dog team
business?
Oh,
no. We had many other dog teams up in the mining camps.
Mm-hmm.
But we never had a dog team up at Upper Russian Lake.
Mm-hmm.
Because by that time, you were not allowed to catch salmon to feed your dogs. And if you had to feed a dog team the year around, it cost a lot more than it did to rent an airplane to bring your supplies in.
Sounds like a reasonable.
Yes. So we never had a dog team at Upper Russian Lake. And tourists who used to come there used to say, "Why don't you have a dog? This would be such a nice place for a dog." And I said, "Well, anywhere you people go, you can see a dog or many dogs." But I said, "How many places can you come into the front yard and see the wild game that we have here? Because my husband tamed everything that set foot in the front yard."
Is that right?
Yes, we had a pet mink who lived under the house. and we had about 20 spruce grouse who could be photographed. They would get in the ace pile of ashes and dust, or they would be picking gravel, or the little strutter, as we called him, would be strutting back and forth like a turkey cock.
Yeah.
And we had squirrels that came, and they were tame, and they would eat out of your hand. And we had the gray jays, whiskey jacks, camp robbers,
yeah, and they
would come and feed out of your hands. And the moose used to come walk through the garden, and the bears used to come and fish for salmon on our beaches. And if the animals didn't molest us or our belongings, we didn't molest them. And so we had a regular zoo.
Well, what a wonderful experience for someone to have.
Yes, it was.
And what a very plausible reason for not having a dog.
Yes, and I burned up many a meal running with my movie camera to get pictures of all these things. And I still have the movies, and it's like visiting back home to see them.
That's wonderful.
Yes, it is.
Coming, when I drove down from Anchorage, from Fairbanks, I left Friday night, and then I came partway and then drove in yesterday to Palmer. And within an hour's time, or less than, well, about an hour's driving, I was just driving slowly and taking my time and just enjoying it. I was by myself, and I don't get by myself very often, and I was really enjoying it. I saw four moose.
Oh, good.
The other side of Wausau.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what mileposts they were, but there was the bull. It was right by the road, feeding on, browsing there.
Yeah.
Had horns not too big. And then the others, two cows right near the road, and the other one was too far away. I couldn't tell if it was a bull or a cow.
But it's nice to see the wild game,
nice
isn't it?
It's nice to see the wild game. And
well,
it was 3 weeks ago, yesterday, I guess. It was Saturday morning. I got up early, and I had to go to town. And that fur neck piece I had on, I had that on. And I have a fur hat that goes with it. I opened the front door, and there was a cow moose right at our front door.
Oh, no.
We live out of town about 7 miles from Fairbanks. And so I got my husband. He was still in bed, and I ran and got him. I said, Jim, come quick. You'll never believe what's here. And he thought something was happening.
Yeah.
Or the garage is on fire or something. And I opened the door, and there's that moose dead, and they're looking at it. I thought that was a good surprise.
What a surprise.
No, so he said it was a cow, and it looked as though it was about, you know, almost full grown. It wasn't quite a full grown. But it was very friendly. And so I closed the door, and he says, oh, the poor thing must be hungry. He went to the fruit bowl and got an apple. He said, here, give it to him. Well, our daughter, when she was little, got nipped by a horse on the shoulder. And I'll never forget that. It was such a bruise. And I've always been impressed with horses and moose and animals that use their lips for browsing and for tearing and for eating. And here I'm standing there with this apple. I thought, uh-oh, there goes my hand. Because realizing how big they're, I hadn't been that close to a moose's head before. And I was going to take it right out of my hand. I thought, well, I better not. I use my fingers to type all the time. I can't lose my fingers.
No.
So I dropped it. And then while the moose was getting the apple, I went back in and got my Rolleiflex camera, which has a flash.
Yeah.
So I took about 8 pictures.
Oh, good.
And then, I think the moose would have walked right in the house. I'd left the door open.
Imagine that.
But Jim says he went back and got another apple.
Did it pick it up off the ground?
Yeah.
Good.
One, it managed to get it in its mouth, and then it fell out, and then it got down on its knees to get it the second time.
Oh,
so
yes.
I got a picture of the moose right there at the front door on its knees.
Yeah, I've seen them get down on their knees to get things.
This is right at the front, and I just was with them. One picture I'm having blown up for my son to give to him. Anyway, it's really exciting to have an animal like that.
Oh, it is. I'll tell you one about moose. When we lived at Yakima, we had some young neighbors not far away, and then we came on north. And after we got the lodge, why, they had grown up, and they came north and came to our lodge on a fishing trip. And they drove up over the highway. And they thought, sure, they'd see moose, you know, all along the way. They wanted to see moose in their natural habitat. And they went all through Canada and never saw a moose. And they got over the line into Alaska, and they thought, now surely we'll see moose. And they went on and on, and no moose. And it was summer. And all at once, they went around a curve, and there was four animals there feeding along the highway. And they stopped and backed up in a hurry. And instead of four moose, it was four elephants. Elephants, kindly. The Shriner had brought the first circus to Alaska. Oh, and they came over the highway. And the elephant truck had broken down, and they'd put the elephants out to graze while they fixed it. And so my friends couldn't see anything but elephants, and they thought they were going to change their brand of whiskey, I guess.
Well, but
and they never did see a moose until they got to our place, and then they saw one right in the front yard.
I remember when the first elephants came to Fairbanks. I think it was about 1954, something like that. Was that about the time they came up?
Yeah.
Because, let's see, I think it was about 1954. I'll never forget that everybody in town came out to see
Oh, naturally, yeah.
The Alaskans, particularly the Indians and Eskimos.
They'd never seen anything like that.
Yeah, just fantastic. What a great thrill for people.
Yes.
Well, tell me about your African trip, the dream trip to Africa that you and your husband made.
Well, we bought a picture safari, and it was really very rewarding. First, when we were in Nairobi, the first morning we were in Nairobi, here come a big fella in native costume knocking on our hotel door and wanted to know if we wanted to go out and see the lions. Of course, we wanted to see the lions. And there is a park out of Nairobi, about 10, 12 miles out of town, and it's fenced. And all the wild African game is in there. And this guide, made his living that way, taking people out to photograph the animals. So away we went with this guide to start with. And we photographed a lot of the animals there. Well, then I went to Carr and Downey, the famous outfitters, and bought a picture safari. And it was in Amboseli Park, which is down in the country of the Maasai warriors. And that's, 60 or 100 miles south of Nairobi. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful country down there. As we drove along, you see all these beautiful clouds, piled up along that country in the thorn trees. And my husband says, no wonder our friends Grant and Dorothy Collins loved this country. They had been there before us and told us so much about it. Well, our driver was a big black boy, and those natives down there are not shiny black like our Negroes. They're a dull matte black, mm-hmm. and very thin. Most of them are very thin and skinny. And the rangers down at this park were native fellas like that, and they wore a cap like a zouave, like a the old legions used to wear. And one of the wardens rode with the driver on all these safari trips. Well, the camp there at Amboseli was really out of this world. We had tents, and it was one great big tent for dining. And the native boys wore long green or red robes, and they were barefooted and had fezes on top of their heads. They were very, very colorful. Mm-hmm. But they all spoke good English. And the food was marvelous, although it was all cooked in what I would call Dutch ovens out over open fires. Mm-hmm. And a native cook, but he really was a marvelous cook. And he even made crepes one day when there were some Frenchmen there. We weren't the only ones in camp. There were other cars and drivers coming and going to the camp. Well, we had this tent that we slept in, and it had mosquito nets, naturally. And the boy would wake us up early in the morning and give us a cup of tea. But usually before he came around, at daylight, the little monkeys up in the trees would start chattering. They lived in the trees.
Yeah.
And they would wake up and chatter, and then you'd hear the lions roaring off in the distance. They were their morning kill, they were having their breakfast. And that's the sound we woke up to every morning, the lions roaring and the monkeys chattering. Well, we got a kick out of these little monkeys. They were mischievous, and the boys were always chasing them out of the tents because they'd go in the tents and carry everything off that was loose. And I have a movie of one of the old monkeys and some of the little ones, and there was a lot of high grass and down timber off to one side of the tent. And this old monkey would get up and sit on top of this snag as a lookout. And the little young monkeys would sneak through the high grass, and you couldn't see them coming, and be coming sneaking up behind the tent and going in the tent. And she would warn them if anyone was coming to chase them. So that was one of the funny highlights.
Yeah, I bet that's a humorous movie.
Yes, it was. Well, then the driver would take us around to all the animals, and he would drive up so darn close. And I had a new movie with a telephoto lens on it, and he would drive so close I would have to get the telephoto lens off before I took the pictures. And I would keep telling him, "Don't get so close," but he would just roll his eyes and grin at me, not say a word, and just get right up alongside the lions or anything else. And I had read a lot of stories about the rhinos and the elephants, you know, that charged the cars. And he kept showing us so many rhinos. And we had heard about Gertie. Gertie was a character amongst the rhinos that we heard about when we were over in Australia before we got to Africa. Mm-hmm. And she had the longest horn in Africa. I think it was 4 feet long. And so when we got to Amboseli, we asked the driver if he could find Gertie. And he said yes, he could find Gertie, but he was sorry, but she'd broken off her horn. She'd had a calf, and she'd been in a fight defending the calf and broke off her long horn. So he found Gertie, but she didn't have that long horn. But I bought a picture of her, a slide, when she did have it, so I have a picture of her. And I asked him, "How are you going to get away if one of these things charges?" And he wouldn't say anything. He'd just grin, roll his eyes. And one day, a rhino did charge us. But it only came halfway and changed its mind and stopped. So we were only half charged by a rhino. But we really did get charged by an elephant.
Did you?
He explained to us that when you run into a lone elephant by itself, it's usually an old renegade that's been driven out of his herd by younger bulls. Mm-hmm. And he's old and bad tempered, and you just better beware of him. Well, the driver used to wake us up real early and get us out real early, because that was a good time to see the animals before they laid down and went to sleep in the heat. Well, it was before breakfast, and we ran into this lone elephant, and he was having his breakfast off, pulling down the branches off a tree. Well, he didn't want to be interrupted, and he turned and came for us. And we were just in ruts. We weren't on a road. It was just ruts through the sand. And his old ears came out, you know, and he trumpeted and came for us. And that driver wheeled so fast out into the brush, and it was a brush about that high, but he wheeled his car right out into that to get away from the elephant. And the elephant was kicking up such a bunch of cloud of sand. And I was taking movie pictures out the back of the window, and all I got was a big cloud of sand, a big cloud of dust. But we really got charged by that one, but that driver certainly got away from him in a hurry. Yeah. And if he had, you know, pardon me.
You sold your lodge then in 1959,
mm-hmm.
and you sold it to Ward Gay, Big Game Guide.
Yeah, sorry.
And then Ward Gay, you say, sold it?
He sold Dr. Romig.
Mm-hmm. Is that Dr. Howard Romig?
Sorry?
Is he still alive?
Yes. But I don't know whether he's practicing or not. I was told that he'd had a stroke and He has a cabin down at Cooper's Landing, and I think he's down there right now. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he's practicing right now.
But he bought the Elwell's Fishing Lodge, no longer called Elwell's Fishing Lodge. Did he buy it just as a winter home or a summer home or fishing lodge?
Yeah, summer home.
I was talking to someone in Juneau not too long ago. I made a trip to Juneau first of this month, first of December. And I talked to the McKinnons down there. And Sim McKinnon was born in, I think it's James Simpson McKinnon. But anyway, everyone calls him Sim McKinnon. He was born in Juneau in 1897. And he was appointed to Annapolis by delegate to Congress, James Wickersham.
Yeah.
And went through Annapolis. At any rate, he served time in the Navy. He and his wife went over, they were in China, and then he got out in 1926, and he was called back into service in 1939. He was on active reserve, called back in, and went through the war in the Aleutians. He's telling me about Dr. Romig. He had him, came into Anchorage, and I'm not sure how he got him into the Navy, but he got him into the Navy, and they took him down to ADAC with him as the doctor.
Yeah.
And then they went out to Kiska, I think. He was out there, too, for a couple of years. He told me a story about Dr. Romig. He came into town one time and took one of Dr. Romig's dogs out. That was the only dog out there on Kiska for a while during World War II. So I've never met Dr. Romig. So
haven't you?
No. But you say he does have a cabin at Cooper's Landing.
Yeah.
When I lived at Barrow, we ordered some smoked canned salmon from Cooper's Landing. Some person down there made it and sold it by the case. And we got a case of it. And that was the best smoked salmon I ever
I know the old fella that used to do that. He's dead now.
Yeah. Oh, that was delicious.
Pardon me.
It was a real treat up that far north.
Oh, yes.
We didn't have... And at that was 1950, I guess, or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't... Now you can buy canned salmon in Alaska, or gourmet cans.
You can if you can afford it.
If you can afford it, yeah, right.
Isn't that awful the way they charge for that stuff?
Which brings me to you. Did you do, when you lived out there, did you do a lot of canning and preserving, or...
Nope.
No?
Mm-mm.
Did you grow a garden in the summer?
Yes, we had a big garden.
Well, you must preserve vegetables then in a root cellar for the winter?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't really have to can?
No.
I don't suppose you had to worry about meat very much.
Oh, no. We always had meat. Mm-hmm. But after we established it as a lodge, we couldn't serve wild meat, naturally.
Yeah.
I had to order my meat from town then. Mm-hmm. But in the winter, when we were alone, we always used wild meat.
What was your favorite wild meat?
Is oh, sheep, naturally.
It was it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What kind of, were you allowed to shoot the female sheep or just the...
No.
Just the...
Rams.
Rams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Would a trophy ram, would that necessarily mean that the ram was an older sheep?
Yes.
If it had a trophy, trophy head?
Yeah.
What kind of meat was that? Was that pretty tough, or was it pretty good?
White sheep?
No, if you shot a trophy sheep, you'd use the meat.
Yes, naturally. Uh-huh. No.
But was it pretty good meat, or was it tough?
Well,
it was an old animal.
I can say that I never have eaten tough sheep meat.
Mm-hmm.
I never found any of it to be tough.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the mooses are tough, can't stick a fork in the gravy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Depends on the time of year that you get it.
Right.
You get it early when it's in its prime and has a lot of tallow on it. It's usually tender.
The moose.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we lived out in the woods, and you had to wait until, at that time there was a late season, and you had to wait until after it froze up before you got your meat, or your winter's meat wouldn't keep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by then, it was usually lean and tough and not so good as the early kill.
Did you ever have it? Did you have any permafrost in that area? So you
no.
Could use
no.
I know up in the interior, many areas of Alaska, people have permafrost or ice cellars.
Yeah.
And they could keep meat all summer or...
Yeah, we mined up there on Birch Creek one time years ago, north of Chattanooga. And they had one of those permafrost cellars there.
Oh, that was up near Circle.
Yeah.
That Birch Creek, yeah.
Yeah, it was between Chattanooga and Circle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I see.
That's all right. Mm. And back in those days, that was before Birdseye established this frozen food process. Well, the old Alaskan sourdoughs had it long before he did. Because mm-hmm. when we went up to camp that year, we went in the spring. And the custom was, when they left the camp in the fall, the cook would bake up a big batch of bread and put it outside, freeze it up hard, put it in cans in the cache. And he would cook up a big pot of beans and a big pot of soup and cover it over and put it in the cache. And they would leave a haunch of caribou hanging there and whatever else. So when they came back in the spring, everything was ready. All you had to do was thaw it out and mm-hmm. your meal was ready.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I found when I got to this camp that spring. And you get in there, you know, you've been on a trail and you've been breaking trail on snowshoes and you're tired and wet. And it's sure nice to have a meal
yeah.
already cooked up. All
yeah.
you have to do is thaw it out.
Right.
But in this cache, there were a few eggs that had been left over from the autumn before. And it had been 70 below in there that winter before we got there. And you know those eggs were hard cooked. The frost, the frost had cooked them.
Is that right?
Yeah, the yolks never did thaw. You could the whites thawed out, finally, but the yolks never thawed. They were just like hard cooked eggs.
That right?
Yeah. So that's the way it went with the frozen food stuff in those days.
Well, when did your husband, when was his last real hunting season?
You mean what year?
What year?
What last year he was able to hunt?
Yes.
Well, let's see. It must have been 58,
mm-hmm.
because he didn't hunt in 59.
Mm-hmm.
58 must be the last year that he guided.
I see. Did he have a heart attack or stroke or
yes.
break a leg or?
Yeah, he had a heart condition and then he got a lot of strokes and he used to come out of them, but they left him disabled, so he had to use a cane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you were able to travel because a man who was that active. All of his life,
yeah.
You know, he needed something.
Keep him busy.
To keep him busy.
Yes, yes that's why we did.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't stand it to see the rest of his fellow guides going off in the autumn without him. So
yeah.
We just got away from there, so he wouldn't have to see it.
We made this one trip to Africa. Did that take you around the world? And was
yeah.
that a long, long extended trip? Or
yes, yes. We had a friend who was a travel agent. And what started us out, my husband had been reading about what big rainbow trout they had in New Zealand, how much bigger they were than ours. And he wanted to get down there and see if they were. So we figured to go to New Zealand, and our friend laid out the trip for us. And she said, now, you don't want to come back the same way. You might as well keep going. She took the globe and pointed to it and says, when you're here, you might as well keep on going
yeah.
around the rest of the way,
is
to come back the same way. So she twisted our arm into that trip, and I'm sure glad that she did, because we went first to Hawaii, and then from Hawaii we went down Fiji Islands into New Zealand. And by the way, in New Zealand, the trout weren't any longer than ours that we had at home, but they weighed more, they were heavier. They were built deeper through,
mm-hmm.
and consequently they weighed more.
They weighed more.
Yes.
But they weren't longer.
No, he didn't get any longer than we had in our own front yard up yeah. in Alaska. Well, anyway, we went on from New Zealand to Australia, and from Australia across to the islands in the Mauritius Island and some of the islands in the southern Indian Ocean, And then from there on to South Africa and up to Nairobi. From Nairobi, we flew north to Italy. From Italy to Switzerland. We stayed quite a while in Switzerland. We loved it there. And then we went on north to Denmark. And from Denmark, we flew home over the North Pole back to Alaska.
Came so full you were circle. Gone for about a year, do you think?
Yes, that's right.
Wonderful trip. Uh-huh. Did you know people in Switzerland?
No.
You just liked it, so you stayed?
Yeah.
When you, if you stayed any length of time in one of these countries, did you rent a house or did you stay in a hotel? Or?
On that trip, we stayed in hotels. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, when we went back to Mexico and to Hawaii, we rented apartments for the winter. Mm-hmm. After the trip, every winter we would pull out when the terminal dust started coming down on our own mountains. We'd pull out live on some tropical beach over winter.
Oh, wonderful!
It was lovely.
I'd like to spend a month or two in a warm place like that somewhere.
Yes.
Not so much for me because I lived in Arizona before I came to Alaska. And I know what it is to enjoy the warm winters.
Mm-hmm.
Just for my husband to get a rest.
Yeah, sure.
It just puts in too much time. Back to the guiding years and hunting years, did you accompany your husband on any of these hunts?
Oh, yes, a lot of them. I didn't at first when he was hunting with Andy Simons and Hank Lucas. I didn't go with him then because they had their own cooks and packers. But after he was guiding on his own, I always went along and did the cooking in the hunting camps.
So you were packing a pack and just like the men?
That's right.
Did he ever have any women hunters?
Oh, yes. Lots of different ones.
When you went on a trip like that with him and cooked, describe a typical morning when you got up and you had tents, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, we had tents and we had wood stoves and all of them.
Oh, you had your own camps that you went to?
Oh, yes. We flew everything along with us. And by the time that Luke started guiding on his own, everything was airplanes.
I see.
And you hired the pilots with the big planes, and it was just like moving an army.
Mm-hmm.
With all, when you outfitted a big hunting party and expected to stay a month, it took a lot of
food and a lot of gear.
Yeah, that's right. It took a lot of it.
Well, in the morning, if you were the cook on the crew, would you get up first?
Well, not always. Usually the packer got up and build all the fires. That was the packer's job.
Mm-hmm.
The packer or the bull cook. Some parties that were big, one of the packers was also the bull cook to help with the cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And he went around in all the tents and made all the fires so it'd be warm to get up by.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, it was nice. That was his job. That's what he's getting paid for. But
how nice for the clients.
Yes.
That's what I meant.
Yes, it was nice.
And well, then you'd get up and what would you fix for breakfast? Give me an idea of what you would cook for breakfast on one of these.
Oh, everything. Everything. We had all kinds of dry cereal. And if they like cooked cereal better,
mm-hmm.
I cook cereal. We always had canned fruit. And we had oranges and grapefruit, things like that we took along with us. And the clientele expected the best. They were paying a lot of money, and
mm-hmm.
and they wanted the best of everything, and were willing to pay for it. So we took everything they had in the grocery along.
Yeah, I see.
We had fruit and cereal, and bacon and eggs or ham, and toast, everything you can think of for breakfast. We had it. And the guides and packers, you couldn't fill them up.
I imagine. Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
Tough. You need a lot of energy when you're
yes,
out.
Yes, you do. Climbing those mountains all day long, getting home late.
Well, if you were the cook then, you stayed in camp most of the time, and that must have occupied your full day just cooking.
And No, I had a lot of time because they were all gone at noon. I packed lunches for them. They took their lunches.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I got things out of...
So you baked your bread while you're out in these camps,
oh, yes.
Too?
Uh-huh, yeah.
You made everything.
Yeah.
That must have taken quite a lot of organizing for a shopping list.
Well,
before you left, you'd have to...
I had standard lists.
Mm-hmm.
A standard list that I ordered for every hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it simple.
Did you, in your early days when you went out, did you ever forget anything really important, like the baking powder, or...
Nope.
You were too organized for that, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I was lucky. I never forgot anything.
Yeah. I have to make lists, too. So it's the only way to be organized on something like that.
Yeah.
Well, if a hunter, in a typical hunt where you were cooking, if a hunter bagged trophy sheep that day and brought it down, would you have sheep for dinner?
Well, in those days, you could serve wild meat in camp if the hunters killed it.
Hunter killed it, you could?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, we always ate meat in camp.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't supposed to waste any meat, you know.
Yeah. How would you cook? You flew in a stove.
Yeah.
When you went in.
We had a wood
so
stove.
So you could fry meat, or you could even roast it or
yes.
bake it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite way of cooking wild sheep?
Well, I like it fried. Actually, you know, those chops, those lovely chops and fillets.
Yeah.
Of course, the sheep roast is good too. Part of the animal has to be roasted.
Yeah. How do you season it? Or do you season it at all? Just salt and pepper and...
Yeah, I like bay leaves and celery seed, things mm-hmm. like that.
And do you make a gravy with the roast?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just like you would with a round beef roast or something.
Yes.
Treated the same
That's
way.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Same way.
I've never had... Well, I've had wild sheep once, I think, in Alaska. Had lots of moose. We ate a lot of moose this year. My son got a moose a year ago. I wish you'd gotten another one this year with the price of meat right now.
I've been lucky too. I have some young proteges. I call them my teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
I was sick and in and out of the hospital for 4 years, and during that time I couldn't do any work. And these teenagers are the children of one of my old friends, and they came and did my chores for me. They did what work had to be done. Otherwise I wouldn't have been able to live alone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I call them my teenagers. Well, they're growing out of their teens now. And one of the boys had a chance to go sheep hunting this year, but he didn't have any rifle. And his family has 4 kids in college, so, you know. I felt that they shouldn't have to go and buy a rifle for him. And his dad's rifles are all such big old heavy things, bear guns. So I got my old 253,000 Savage out and gave it to the boy. And he got a sheep. He had a beginner's luck. He got a sheep on his first sheep hunt. And then afterwards he went hunting and got a moose.
Wonderful.
So I've been well supplied with sheep and moose lately.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, that'll be a prize gun for him.
Yes.
I mean, he's got a personal relationship with him,
uh-huh.
too.
Yes, it has a history.
And it has such a history.
Yeah.
Have you bagged a lot of animals with it yourself?
Well, I've shot about everything but a goat. I never shot a goat.
Mm-hmm. What's the difference between a goat and a ram?
Well, a ram is the male of a wild sheep. And the male of a goat is a billy goat.
Well, we have both in Alaska.
Oh, yes.
You know, you can tell I'm not a hunter. I don't know much about it.
Yeah.
Are the goats as... I guess they're not as plentiful as the sheep.
Oh, no. No, they're not as plentiful.
What is the difference between a goat and a sheep? A goat is just...
Well, a goat stands about this high at the shoulder. He's much higher than a sheep
higher
and weighs much more.
Oh, I see.
And he has wool on him. And where a sheep has hair, hollow hair. This brittle one breaks.
Yeah.
A goat has wool in underneath. You know, the southeastern Indians used to use that wild goat wool to make those Chilkat blankets.
Oh, yeah. But is about to run out. I would like to put another one on and ask you a couple more questions, if you have the time.
Oh, yes. Time's all I got.
Are the goats in Alaska, are they in most of the mountain ranges or just
no,
certain areas?
Just certain areas where the feed is right for them.
Yeah. Huh. That's one thing you didn't get, was a goat.
Yeah. I never had a desire to shoot a goat.
Mm-hmm. Is the meat a goat meat? Is we threw it.
That X like my movie projector.
Enjoyed that visit I had with you in September. That was lovely sitting in your yard.
Yeah, wasn't that
airplane
nice?
That airplane reminded me of it. Your yard really looks nice. Do you do a lot of the work, yard work yourself?
Yeah. I couldn't for 4 years, but I got over that now.
What was your problem?
Asthma.
And
the heart. When you have asthma bad, you cough so hard it affects your heart.
I see.
The last 2 years I've been pretty good. I still have that asthma, you can hear it in my voice.
Yes. Mm-hmm.